And hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is no one. I am all by myself this week. Everyone's very, very busy. All the regulars, I'm afraid. So it will just be me here this week, and I will talk to myself and talk to you. So I'll do my usual intro. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new dinosaur action adventure, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Now that's in the back half of the show. For the first half, since I'm alone, I thought I would, queue up some of the potential reviews we're going to be doing in the next month and look at similar films. And since we're talking about a lot of sequels, it is the summer after all. I'm going to talk about some of the previous films in this series of for the new films that are coming out in the next month, and talk about what's to like about those, or maybe what's not to like. So I'm going to start with, we have next week coming out, Sicario, Day of the Soldad, which is the sequel to the 2015, movie, Sicario, which was directed by Denis Villeneuve. It's an interesting film. It's a very grim film, I would say. I think it's probably the best movie ever made about the war on drugs, or the drug war. It's kind of in your face with the cynicism and the brutality and the just sort of the dark arts of enforcing U.S. drug policy. And there's kind of like really no heroes. Even to go back to something like Traffic, the Steven Soderbergh movie, which I know Vince is a fan of. we talked about it a couple of weeks ago. But, there was ideas in that were very much, the idea that there were good people just trying to do their best. I think in this, in Sicario, there really are. The idea that these are good people doing their best is kind of a farce. Even the one kind of quote unquote good character, which is the FBI agent played by Emily Blunt, even she in the end sort of willfully goes into these situations knowing that they are bad situations in the hopes that that she can, put some level of justification on it. I don't think she ever accepts the situation, but she kind of does accept the situation in the end, which is this fairly complicated plot about disrupting several of the different cartels in Mexico in order to effectively create one cartel, which would then be controllable until when the Josh Brolin character says, until Americans stop buying cocaine, which is kind of the cynical root at all of this, that the drug war is caused because Americans love drugs, and there are policymakers who don't like that, and so it's tough. Benicio del Toro is really good in that, but del Toro and Brolin are the ones returning for Day of the Soldad. I think even though it's written by Taylor Sheridan, obviously Denis Villeneuve did not come back because he was in the middle of making Blade Runner 2049. I do have confidence in Sheridan's script because he's proven himself a very good writer. He basically had a hat trick there with Sicario, Hell or High Water, and Wind River, which are all great films. I do question whether or not the sort of moral ambivalence of Sicario may be sacrificed to go deeper into these characters played by Brolin and Del Toro, who effectively see themselves as villains and are okay with that. Whether we might get into like sort of a realm of cartoonish supervillainy about the whole thing. So I mean, that's a concern. More concerning or less concerning, I guess, maybe depending on your point of view. The week after that, the fourth in the Purge series comes out, except it's a prequel. It's called The First Purge. If you know the Purge film series. It's about one night in America where all crime is legalized, including murder. And the idea is that because the American public is able to purge themselves of negative emotions and, you know, feelings of brutality, that the other 364 days of the year, America is a paradise, a reborn, renewed, faithful country. And what sort of seemed like kind of a winking, knowing sort of smart satire of Americana in that first Purge movie sort of feels a bit more real as we go into the fourth one, living in Donald Trump's America. And indeed, the first poster that was released for the first Purge was an image of a MAGA hat, or a MAGA-style hat, a red baseball cap that says the first Purge on it. And there's a real opportunity here, I think, for this film to dig deeper and more deeply and more introspectively into the idea of the Purge and the themes of the Purge, because it can be so reflective. And in what's happening in the news right now, where we see in the United States, there's just this terrible amount of cruelty right now in regards to, people who desperately need health care, immigrant children who are separated from their parents, workers' rights, environmental rights, queer rights. It's a really difficult time right now to find some measure of grace in terms of how the government acquits itself. So all that stuff being poured into this prequel, the first Purge, which shows like how the Purge was initiated, and I think it takes place on Staten Island, and Staten Island is sort of the test case, the beta test for the Purge. And we see also the conspiracy that's in the background of the Purge movies and how that came about, how the government is using the Purge to methodically eliminate people who are poor, people who are desperate, immigrants, you know, sort of the quote-unquote undesirable class, which is, of course, very reflexive of what's happening in the United States right now. There is, to a certain subset of the population of the United States, there is an undesirable class in the country, and they are typically people who are not Christian, white, or straight. So I think for a good primer of this is to go to the previous Purge movie, Purge Election Year, which shows the end of the Purge, because it's about a presidential candidate played by Elizabeth Mitchell, who I think was cast in no small way to evoke Hillary Clinton, because this film was released in 2016. So it's about this presidential candidate running to basically end the Purge, and the conspiracy trying to end her by trying to make sure she's among the murdered on Purge night. And Frank Grillo's character, who first appeared in the second Purge movie, trying to protect her. And I found that to be, at least on a satirical level, a well-done Purge movie. I haven't revisited it since I saw it in the theaters in summer 2016. I think it might be too hard, but we'll see how the first Purge does. So there's something a little bit lighter the next weekend after that. Or I guess a couple of days after that. The Purge is being released on the United States 4th of July, which is on Wednesday. And then on the 6th, we are getting the second Ant-Man movie. It's called Ant-Man and the Wasp. And if you go back and watch the first Ant-Man, it's kind of a jaunty little fun heist movie. And I'm going to play a clip just because it's the dynamic between the characters is really fun.
Thank you for the coffee, ma'am. It's not too often that you rob a place and they get welcome back, because we just robbed you.
You know that he was arrested for stealing a smoothie machine, right?
Two smoothie machines.
Are you sure they can handle this?
Oh, we can handle it. We're professionals.
You'll forgive us if we're not instilled with confidence.
Well, hey, everybody, just kick back and relax a little bit, man. We know our business. We broke into this spooky-ass house, didn't we?
I let you.
Well, one could say that I let you let me.
Look, it's okay. They can handle this.
Yeah, we can handle it.
You got their credentials?
He's in the system.
I'm in the system. This is him?
Yeah, we're doomed.
you can sort of hear it in the way that scene goes and the way those characters interact. Michael Douglas plays Hank Pym, who's a scientist that has created a mechanism for shrinking oneself using a kind of suit. Paul Rudd plays the man who he's trying, Scott Lang, who's trying to get his life together. He's a former criminal. He has criminal associates there. Pym hires Lang to basically steal back his formula to stop this supervillain type from trying to replicate the Pym particle, which is the thing that shrinks you. Ant-Man and the Wasp looks to pick up after that. If not to get into the full Marvel rigmarole and who was in what, but Ant-Man was in Civil War, the third Captain America movie, where he was part of the Cap's sort of renegade team of superheroes. He ends up in prison. This is about how it takes place after that, and he's been under house arrest until he's recruited by Dr. Pym and his daughter Hope, who is the now the Wasp. She also has a shrinking suit, but it also has wings to complete the Wasp imagery. But I think what we've seen from the trailers so far indicates, because it's the same director, Peyton Reed, there's going to have a lot of that great action sequence. So, like, one of the great things about the Ant-Man movie was this climactic battle, where it's not really about world destruction. It's very personal and very focused. And one of the things we have in that final battle is it takes place on Scott's daughter's room, but because they're shrunk down and they're fighting each other at ant size, it's Ant-Man and the villain Yellow Jacket. So it has this great dynamic where it shows the scale of the fight at their level and then the scale of the fight at regular size level, and it's really quite hilarious to see that those two elements at work, but also genuinely fun and exciting too. So I think most of the cast is returning for Ant-Man and the Wasp, including Paul Rudd and Michael Douglas and Evangeline Lilly, Michael Pena, who you heard there. There's also new characters played by Lawrence Fishburne. Michelle Pfeiffer plays Hank Pym's wife, and to what capacity we will see that is unknown, because we thought that Hank Pym's wife, who was the original Wasp, was dead. So this will be very interesting to see. It'll also be the first movie to come out after Avengers Infinity War, and for the fans, how stuff plays in to the overall what's going on with the franchise, because we know Ant-Man, although not in Infinity War, will be in Avengers 4. I'm sort of less interested in that stuff and more just watching like a really great, rousing, fun adventure in the Ant-Man mold, as was revealed in that first Ant-Man movie, which was a real surprise and a genuine pleasure. Moving right along, the week after that, we get another movie starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson. It is called Skyscraper. And it makes me wonder if Dwayne Johnson is trying to do a thing where he's trying to star in remakes of all of Irwin Allen's disaster movies, because he did one a couple of years ago called San Andreas, which was about an earthquake in California that basically wipes out the west coast of the United States. And in that, he plays a rescue copter pilot. In Skyscraper, he plays like a former FBI agent that's now a security consultant, and there's some kind of terrorist shenanigans that results in a fire on this, like, it's bigger than the Burj Khalifa, I think, in terms of the size of this building, and he has to save his family. His wife's played by Neve Campbell, and they have two small children, Guelph Treasure, Neve Campbell. But in San Andreas, it's a similar plot. Johnson has to try and get to from L.A. to San Francisco to save his daughter, played by Alexandra Daddario. And what I think like about that movie, I mean, it's stock full of like disaster movie cliches, no doubt. But what I like about that movie is that the daughter character, she has a positive, very life-affirming relationship with her father, because you normally in these movies, the parent has to save the child to make up for lapses. See Day After Tomorrow or 2012 as previous examples. But, you know, it's seen very early on in the film that they are a very loving father-daughter relationship. And it's also proof in that, and you're seeing scenes of the daughter, and she meets a man and his little brother in San Francisco, and they're trying to get to higher ground so they can meet up with Johnson's father. And it shows her at various times sort of using this knowledge on, you know, on first aid and safety and procedure that she's learned from her father to help save the other two and get them out of sticky situations. And I didn't enjoy that she wasn't not only that she wasn't a damsel in distress kind of character, but she was also a very proactive character and who had essential knowledge in terms of how to navigate a crisis. That, I think, is a very winning element to San Andreas. Interestingly, too, it was made, San Andreas was made by Brad Peyton, who also directed Dwayne The Rock Johnson in another disaster movie earlier this year, Rampage, which was based on the video game. We didn't review that on the show, and I haven't had a chance to catch up on it myself, but I did enjoy playing the arcade game Rampage. That may not necessarily translate, though. I am running out of time here before I have to get to the review, so I'll try and get through these as quick as I can. After that, or that same week, Equalizer comes out, which is Equalizer 2, I should say, which is based on the old TV series starring Edward Woodward about a former spy who's now uses his skills to help out the regular man. Antoine Fuqua turned this into a film in 2016 starring Denzel Washington as the former spy now helping people. I can certainly see why this is appealing, and I saw The Equalizer. I rewatched it again very recently. It's on Netflix, and it's a very enjoyable film in terms of just, you know, being able to sit back and watch something that doesn't require too much in the way of engagement from you as a viewer. It's certainly well made, but it doesn't really invent the wheel. I think it'll be interesting to see if this is a success. Maybe it turns into an ongoing vehicle for Denzel Washington, where every couple of years he comes back as McCall and is saving somebody else. But otherwise, it's, you know, this may be an exercise in futility. I wonder if maybe Denzel Washington might have something better to do with his time. I don't know. Or Antoine Fuqua, for that matter, too. It's, you know, there's really nothing that sets Equalizer apart. This is certainly not like a John Wick kind of thing where, you know, you have this sort of meticulous world building of the criminal underbelly on top of it all. So, I mean, it's, we'll see what happens. Also coming out later in July is Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, which, you know, if there's, it's sort of like the ennui of it is right there in the title, right? It's like, here we go again. But I understand there are fans of the Mamma Mia, the stage play and the original movie. What I will notice, it seems to be like Meryl Streep is not going to be in this one so much, but they do have Cher. I don't know if that is an adequate substitution. It wouldn't be for me, but, you know, what are you going to do? So, you know, it looks like they're going to play some of the same songs again, and, you know, I don't know. It's maybe not for me. I do remember seeing Mamma Mia, and it's, you know, I don't think I'm the target audience for a sequel, but, you know, that may be another one we'll have to wait and see about. You know, ABBA's music's fine, but, you know, I think they've played all the hits already. That brings us to the end of July, and it's another Mission Impossible adventure with Tom Cruise. It's the sixth one, believe it or not. But I want to go back to the first Mission Impossible from 1996, because I think, well, I'll explain it in a minute, but I'm just going to play a clip.
This whole operation was a moment. This whole operation was a moment.
Yeah.
The mole's deep inside. And like you said,
You survived. I will show you something, Ethan. Since your father's death, your family's farm has been in receivership. Now, suddenly, they're flush with over 120 grand in the bank. Your father's illness was supposed to have wiped out that bank account. Dying slowly in America, after all, can be a very expensive proposition. So, why don't we quietly get out of here onto a plane? You can understand you're very upset.
Kittredge, you've never seen me very upset.
You can guess where it goes from there if you haven't seen the movie. I mean, it is 22 years old, but, it's almost sad that Henry Cherney never came back, because it's sort of like an oily kind of gross, administrative figure. He's really good at it. But that was the last we ever saw him, and unless he's coming back in Mission Impossible Fallout, which I somehow, don't think is going to happen. But one of the things I like is, and you can sort of hear the music, Danny Elfman, I really like Danny Elfman's score. It's not like anything Danny Elfman has ever done, either before or since, I don't think. There's a very Hitchcockian vibe, and that's sort of Brian De Palma, who directed that film, his sensibilities, Hitchcock, film noir, and he brings that into this spy movie. There's all these oblique angles, there's a femme fatale, there's characters you can't trust, and this may be an odd comparison, but it makes me think of the first two seasons of Star Trek: The Next Generation, where they're like trying out things and they're like testing the formula and they're not sure what works and what doesn't work yet. I have a lot of admiration and appreciation for those first 2 years of Next Gen because of the experimenting. Because then they get into season three and they settle into formula. And I think it's the same thing with Mission Impossible 3, when J.J. Abrams comes on and they find the formula and it clicks. And, although different directors have come on since then, J.J. Abrams did number 3, Brad Bird did number 4, and then Christopher McQuarrie did 5 and 6. They've sort of been aping that formula. It's not like the first two where you had De Palma and his sensibilities, Wu and his sensibilities, which is what was really interesting at the time, was you have this big, fancy, flashy spy franchise, which seemed like it was going to be very director-driven, for better or for worse, certainly in the case of Mission Impossible 2, where it falls into a lot of all John Woo's very worst tendencies. But I still enjoy that first Mission Impossible and all its De Palma-ness, and I think it might be well worth visiting. I'm not sure if some of the CG effects hold up, especially that last sort of train sequence, but it's fun. And it's sort of fun to look at the way other people have interpreted the material. And it's also peak Tom Cruise. It was from a time where it wasn't maybe icky to like Tom Cruise, before Scientology, before that boat ran ashore. Last but not least, before we get into the review, is Batman Mask of the Phantasm. And I bring this up because Teen Titans Go to the Movies comes out that same weekend, which is, of course, based on Teen Titans Go, the animated series, which is based on the comic book. And I think this was the last time you had a big screen adaptation of a cartoon on a Saturday morning cartoon since 25 years ago when Mask of the Phantasm came out. Before Christopher Nolan, I think Mask of the Phantasm was the best Batman movie, just in terms of how it captured the character. I think you had a greatest story. You had Batman being an actual detective, which is something that even in any of the live action movies, that seems to be something that's kind of glossed over. There's not much detectiving in the Batman movies, considering Batman's the Dark Knight detective, and that always kind of makes me sad. But there is more of that in Batman Mask of the Phantasm, because there's a mystery and there's a character whose identity must be revealed. There's also the Joker, Mark Hamill, doing the voice work of the Joker, probably the best Joker. Outside of Heath Ledger, that's probably a very photo finishy kind of race when we're talking about who had the best Joker. But Yeah, it's still a lot of fun. It's a short kind of 80-minute movie. It does feel like an extended episode of the TV show, but the TV show was extraordinarily well done too, considering the time, considering the audience. It's very well worth revisiting, I think, if you can find it. I don't think it's streaming anywhere, which is sad. It was streaming on Netflix for a while, but now it's not streaming anywhere. But I think at the very least, Mask of the Phantasm is easy to find and is well worth checking out if you want. So that brings us to the end of July. We're obviously not going to be reviewing 8 movies in the next 4 weeks, or 5 weeks, I should say. But hopefully that provides an interesting teaser and maybe gives you some idea of something to check out. When you have time off in the next couple of weeks, or, you know, it's summer vacation time, or, you know, whatever, you just want to check out something. And I got nothing, because my mind's a flurry with dinosaur stuff, and we're going to get into that review in a couple of minutes after a musical break. We're going to talk this week about Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, and we're going to play a way back cut. I hear that on Magic FM all the time, a way back cut. It's from 1993. It is from the album Alapalooza. It is Weird Al Yankovic. And here is his, I don't want to say cover of MacArthur Park, because it's not a cover, but I guess spoof, a spin, a satire, a takeoff of MacArthur Park. And it's, of course, called Jurassic Park. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Do you remember the first time you saw a dinosaur? First time you see them, it's like a miracle. You read about them in books, you see the bones in museums, but you don't really believe it. They're like myths. And then you see the first one alive.
This is not your fault.
But it is.
No. This one's on me. I showed him the way.
And that was a clip from Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. It is the new film by J.A. Bayona, and it stars Chris Pratt, Bryce Dallas Howard, Rafe Spall, Justice Smith, Daniel Pineda, James Cromwell, and Jeff Goldblum. Now, since, as a reminder, I'm here all by myself today, I did what I usually do, is I write out notes about my thoughts on the film, which are based on notes that I make while watching the film. So I'm going to read through my list of notes and, expand on them as needed. The first thing I wrote down, which was, one of the things that bothered me about Jurassic World 1, which I guess is technically Jurassic Park 4. But for these purposes, we'll call it Jurassic World 1, because it's kind of like the start of a whole new trilogy, which is probably where they're going with these things. But there was a certain casual cruelty to that movie. And it's not like these were ever like really bleeding heart films. You might remember what happens to the Richard Schiff character in The Lost World, where he's pretty much like yanked apart by T-Rexes, plural, you know, for like 5 excruciating minutes in the course of the second film. But I mean, there was a point being made, I think, to that sequence, which is the family dynamic of the T-Rex the T-Rexes in that were, you know, they were protecting their baby. So, of course, at least one of the humans had to die. And I guess it was Richard Schiff being low man on the totem pole of Jeff Goldblum, Julianne Moore, Vince Vaughn. So that happened. But when you go back and look at Jurassic World, and I'll talk about the scene that I always think about when I think about Jurassic World, which is there's this scene where Bryce Dallas Howard's assistant, who is played by Katie McGrath, who, you know, you may know, she plays Lex Luthor's sister on Supergirl, and before that she was Morgana Le Fay on the BBC Young Merlin show. Perfectly qualified, lovely actress, lovely woman, I'm sure. But she plays Bryce Dallas Howard's assistant, and there's a sequence where pterodactyls escape their enclosure, and they're attacking the theme park, and they're attacking the visitors. And this poor woman, whose only offense in the film is that she had to look after these two obnoxious boys who were her boss's nephew, and they kind of ditch her. So I guess maybe, you know, not being, you know, good, a good babysitter is maybe justification for all of this. But she's captured by one of the pterodactyls, lifted up in the air, and I guess it's kind of like tenderized a bit, and then it drops her into this like big pool, and then it goes back down, picks her up again, and is taking off with her again when this giant water dinosaur comes up out of the water and eats both her and the pterodactyl that has been plaguing her, the terrorizing her. And that's the end of that chapter. And it's just like, what did this woman do to be pecked to near death by one dinosaur, and then to be eaten with that dinosaur by another bigger dinosaur in the huge water tank in the park? I don't know. But I think it's, you know, I think it was done because it could be done, and someone had to, you know, have the most gruesome death possible, and sadly it was this one woman. But going even further than that, there's so much in the original Jurassic World that's just cool for cool's sake, and there because it's cool. And a lot of that, you know, tends them out into, you know, these scenes of people just being cruel to the dinosaurs and shooting at the dinosaurs, basically treating them as like you would any monster. And I think that was never the tone of the Jurassic Park movies. I think when you go back to the original Jurassic Park, the underlying idea is that how the dinosaurs were made was kind of monstrous. The idea of that this power of genetic engineering would be used to bring back the species that was extinct, that was kind of frightening of itself, but there was still the wonder retained of seeing living dinosaurs in person, at least so far as the characters were concerned, and then seeing them on screen in realized in that way in those very early days of CG. But in Jurassic World, the wonder was gone, and maybe that's part of the subtext. But it was also very disposable as well. The people's reaction to the dinosaurs were very disposable, which is why it's interesting going into Fallen Kingdom. There's almost a whiplash effect to that. I'm not sure if it came from Bayona, because what's interesting is Derek Connolly and Colin Trevorrow. Trevorrow, of course, directed Jurassic World, but they were both the credited screenwriters on Fallen Kingdom, as they were credited co-screenwriters on the first Jurassic World. But I'm not sure where this sudden humanitarian approach to the dinosaurs comes from. Did, you know, Trevorrow and Connolly find, you know, dinosaur gods, so to speak? Or was it Bayona saying, like, hey, you know, these are kind of living, these are supposed to be living things in this world, so we're going to explore this whole angle of animal cruelty? And I think that's an interesting idea, except this is a film that has a lot of stuff ping-ponging around it that it doesn't really settle down with. And there's a spoiler that I won't spoil in the event that my less than charitable review of this film makes you want to see it yourself. I won't spoil it, but there's a character who we learn a very consequential detail about, and that should be kind of at the heart of the film, I feel, in terms of the thematic, in terms of ideas about playing God and you know, rewriting nature's rule book and rewriting, you know, nature's decision. Of course, you have Jeff Goldblum in this reprising his role as chaotician Ian Malcolm. Not sure if chaotician's a word, but let's go with it. And he kind of bookends the movie with his, you know, I think you probably see all his scenes in the trailer, sadly, but, you know, he's testifying at these, you know, odious Senate hearings that are always in these movies about, you know, the U.S. Senate is always having hearings about stuff. But he's talking about, you know, natural selection and playing God and are we doing the right thing? And, you know, welcome to Jurassic World. And, you know, humans and dinosaurs living together, mass hysteria kind of thing. So you have this one character who there's this very consequential reveal about, and it's kind of like, there you go. And then we move on to more running and screaming and chase sequences. I will say that this movie does that somewhat well. I think smartly it takes place off the island, which is sort of, you know, I guess there are two islands technically, because Jurassic Park 2 and 3 took place on a different island. But although interestingly, for you completionists out there, there was a reference back to the Lost World. So those are still canon. You can be assured that the canon still lives, that it's Jurassic Park, Lost World, Jurassic Park 3, and then Jurassic World, because a lot of people thought the Trevorrow had done a thing where it's like, well, maybe 2 and 3 didn't happen, but it happened because it's directly referenced. So, most of it doesn't take place on the island, but I found the setting very bizarre. There's a very haunted mansion quality to where I feel like most of this movie takes place, which is fitting for J.A. Bayona, who once did a film called The Orphanage, which is a haunted house movie itself, but perhaps haunted house motifs are not appropriate for Jurassic Park movies. And so, you know, you almost kind of miss the island in that context. But we do go back to the island. The plot is that the volcano on the island that houses Jurassic World, it was dormant. Now it has come to life and it's threatening to destroy the island. It will cover it with lava, which will effectively cause the re-extinction of the dinosaurs. And you have one of the main characters, Claire, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, who was the administrator of Jurassic World when it all went to pot on her watch in Jurassic World. Now she's a pro-dino, or save the dino, activist, which is another one of these decisions the film makes that's kind of bizarre, because Claire is a very corporate kind of administrator. In the first film, you know, she's very gung-ho about, you know, corporate sponsorship and naming the dinosaurs and, you know, getting more people into the park by creating meaner and more vicious-looking dinosaurs. And, you know, she's kind of right up there in terms of, you know, why the system fails and it becomes a gong show as envisioned in that film. But I guess she had to come to Dino Jesus moment there and is now trying to save them. There's a foundation that we learned that John Hammond, who was played by Sir Richard Attenborough in the first two Jurassic Park movies, he had a partner who he worked with, and this partner, who's played by James Cromwell, is now wanting to save the dinosaurs and take them to a alternative site where they're not going to be exploited. It's just going to be an island where they can, they're not going to be fences and they're not going to be tourists. It's just going to be a wildlife preserve of sorts. So they also want to get the last Velociraptor, which of course was raised by the Chris Pratt character. So that's why Chris Pratt goes along. But I think that's more information I wanted to provide, just so I could say that there are sequences on the island where the volcano erupts, and that's not a spoiler. It's like right there in the trailer. In fact, a lot of people thought that when that first trailer came out, they were giving away the whole movie because it shows the volcano erupting. It turns out the volcano erupting happens in probably the first 30-35 minutes of the movie. It's almost disappointing in a way, because, you know, I think the volcano erupting scenes are very well done in terms of the action and the staging. There's a really great escape scene with Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard and one of the other characters, Justice Smith, who plays like this tech geek kind of guy. Where they're in this like one of the hamster ball things, and it's rolling down the hill away from the erupting volcano, and as all the dinosaurs are kind of stampeding, trying to get out of the way themselves, that there's some real tension there, but there's kind of no build-up to it. They kind of land on the island, and 3 seconds later, the eruption happens. And another thing I found kind of problematic, and it's kind of the fault, maybe not of the movie, but of sort of fate, that, you know, right now there's that volcano eruption on the Big Island where much of Jurassic World was shot in Hawaii, Kalua. It's not Kalua. I'm not going to try and remember it while I'm talking here. But the volcano eruption, we know just how dangerous lava is and how what real lava looks like and how it moves. And so there's a very kind of fake quality to watching this volcano erupt and trying to watch our characters evade it. There's a scene where a character is literally surrounded by the lava as he's trying to escape, which smelled very much of like this that silly Tommy Lee Jones movie Volcano. I enjoy just as like a kind of cheesy funky little disaster movie, but it's silly just the same. I'm not sure silly is a word you want. At least Steven Spielberg ever wanted to ascribe to Jurassic Park movies. But there you go. And so, you know, have this lava. You have people like kind of running from lava and like being like just a few feet away from lava and kind of not feeling its effects. It like, you know, it's hot stuff. No pun intended. But people would be under more pressure. And just, you know, I have to get out of the, I have to get out of the way of this lava. You would be feeling it long before you'd be feeling it, if you know what I mean. I'm looking back at my notes now. Chris Pratt, he really needs to learn how to run. He needs to go to the Tom Cruise school of running, to how to look cool while running. That seems to be a missing tool in his kit. You know, and it kind of disappoints me to say, I think Chris Pratt's charm as this kind of, as the kind of swagger action hero is kind of worn off. I think it worked in Guardians, and it worked to an extent in the first Jurassic World, and, you know, but since then he's done another Guardians, he was in Avengers Infinity War, he did Magnificent Seven, and it just, it's something's not working anymore, he needs to change it up, and I don't think he was particularly lazy in this role, but I think he needed to do something, a bit of a change up, you know, because we get more of these scenes where we're supposed to be in awe of Owen, the Chris Pratt character, of his coolness and his savoir-faire, I guess. You know, when we catch up with him, he's literally living in the middle of nowhere, building a cabin. We're supposed to believe that there was some huge romantic disruption between him and the Bryce Dallas Howard character between movies. And, you know, you kind of never really buy that. One of the things I will say about the first Jurassic World and their dynamic, I think it was very much based on kind of like a classic kind of screwball comedy dynamic. He's the laid back kind of, you know, man of action, and she's, you know, the uptight, you know, person that's all business, and, you know, they're oil and water, and that I think that's what they were trying to get at with setting up that relationship. It doesn't really work because I feel like the portrayal of Claire is kind of leans towards the sexist, but you can see what they were doing. I'm not sure what they were doing here, though. It's they've still kind of got romantic chemistry, but it's kind of all about the mission and trying to save the dinosaurs, and, you know, there's a lot of action going on, and it's a lot of people pondering about the penance of bringing dinosaurs back and the role that, as you heard in that clip, that both Claire and Owen played, because what we find out is that the quote-unquote foundation is really a front to get dinosaurs and then auction them off to basically the worst people in the world, so gangsters and warlords and people in rogue states and pharmaceutical companies and, you know, the ultra rich who just want to hunt the most dangerous game and all that. And I will say, when we first meet the character, Rafe Spall, who's basically the villain, it was pretty obvious that's where it was going. There's something very stolid about this. And one of the things I wrote down, it's later in the notes, but I'll flash forward ahead, is that it feels like these Jurassic Park movies are very much like the Friday the 13th series of movies, the Nightmare on Elm Street series of movies, where it's mainly about getting fresh meat in front of the monsters, except the monsters in this case are the dinosaurs, because it hits the exact same beats. They get to the island and they're in awe, and look at the dinosaurs, isn't this awesome, high five, we have tears in our eyes. And then, you know, the people realize just how much out of control they are, and how much there is to lose, and you know, should we have done this, should we have not have done this, and there's, you know, bioethics. And but then it all comes basically down to a chase scene, and then we get a nice hero shot of the dinosaur roaring, victorious, and then the villain gets theirs in the end. And, you know, no one kind of really stands out. Rafe Spall is like kind of is one of these typical corporate spineless guys who really doesn't, not Rafe Spall, the actor, but who he's playing, is one of these typical corporate spineless guys who just does, you know, he's like, I want to make money, yeehaw. And there's another character in this who's returned from Jurassic World, who I feel like meets the exact same fate at the end of this movie that he meets at the end of the first Jurassic World, where he's just basically put on ice and until he's going to turn up in the third one, which has of course already been greenlit and will come out in 2021. You can look that up. I didn't make that up. It's true. The other thing was Toby Jones puts in an appearance as like an auctioneer, and I don't know what he was doing, but like his like annoying factor was like turned up to 11, and they gave him like a set of fake teeth and a terrible American accent for some reason. It did not work at all. So we have characters who we don't really do anything with. We have bizarro motivations, we have like this loose connective thematic tissue that really doesn't work at all. It's really quite disappointing in a way. And the film ends, and I'm not going to spoil the ending, of course, but I will say, if the ending of Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom feels like it should have been the end of The Lost World. It feels like how the movie should have ended three movies ago. And I don't know if it's like symptom of the kind of glacial pace of development on these films, or, you know, it finally occurred to someone that what people really want to see are the consequences of this, and not just like everybody leaves the island in the end to the dinosaurs and their own devices until we have to go back for some reason. That, you know, there should be bigger, broader, more dangerous consequences in a world where a couple of rich guys took it upon themselves to bring dinosaurs back from extinction. And to comment on the hubris of their decisions and think they can control this. Again, going back to a lot of the stuff Malcolm talks about, which it could have been interesting if he had a bigger role. I don't know if he wanted a bigger role. They just wanted to add a little spice of Goldblum in this. But, you know, that character was kind of the conscience of the first Jurassic Park movie. It's like, you know, yeah, you can do this. And, of course, the classic line, you were so busy trying to... or you were so busy worrying about whether or not you could, you didn't stop and think whether or not you should. And I think that's the line that this film wants to tackle directly, except it never really does. And it's kind of, it feels like there's nothing left to say, even though there's probably a ton more that can be said. And, you know, now that I'm talking, I'm sort of thinking about Westworld, where the show wrapped up its second season on Sunday, but it very wisely decided to expand the universe a bit in its second season, where it's They go to Shogun World, which is, of course, set in feudal Japan, and we see Raja World, which is set in this kind of, like, idyllic sort of imperialistic India with, you know, safaris and, you know, wonderful extravagant outdoor picnics and things. And I wonder if someone could have, sort of done something similar with the Jurassic Park movies. Perhaps there was, like, a, Ice Age experience where you got to go and experience woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers and six-foot-tall sloths and animals that aren't around anymore, but from a different period of time. And, you know, maybe that could be the direction of the film. I don't know. I almost don't want to give them ideas because it's sad that, you know, when you think of Jurassic Park and just how influential it was and how amazing it was and how it sort of fed, you know, the kid in all of us and the universal love of dinosaurs. And in the end, you know, it kind of really doesn't do anything for you anymore. It's purely in the business of just cranking out these sequels because the last Jurassic World movie came out and came back and made a crap ton of money. And so now we have to do the same thing here. And yeah, we can play lip service to those things, but ultimately, it doesn't really add up to much. And you know, you leave the movie and it feels kind of empty in the end. There's really nothing that stands out. There's really no scene that stands out. There's not even a scene like going back to the beginning of my review where, you know, there's no scene of someone dying a horrible, horrible death for no reason for me to glom onto. So, I mean, this is so, I guess to put a bow on this, this is a two thumbs down review of, Jurassic World, The Fallen Kingdom, or I guess it's just Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. Anyway, so let's just end the show there. I will give you everybody's credits since they are off this week. You can find Vince Masson and Jesse Malott on Facebook and Twitter. Vince right now is putting the finishing touches on his short film, which is why he couldn't be here this week. And I'm sure he'll have some more details about that the next time he's on the show. You can listen to Candace on the Village podcast, which you can find on the Bookshelf's website at thebookshelf.ca. And you can find Peter when he's not on the show over at Mr. Towel Rack on Twitter and YouTube. You can buy tickets for Tim's Toronto Fringe play, The Joy of Sax, on FringeToronto.com. The play starts next July 5th at Theatre Passe Morel, main space, and that is in Toronto. And again, you can find all that ticket information online at FringeToronto.com. I will be back here tomorrow, Thursday at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources with Scotty Hertz. Until then, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. And if you want more of the show, you can go to our website at endcreditsradioshow.com or find us on social media, End Credits Radio Show on Facebook, End Credits Radio on Twitter. And for more great programming, stay tuned here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we'll be back here next week, hopefully with more than one person on End Credits, and we will see you then.